Yes, we'll go with it. We'll go with it. Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point Podcast. Today, we are here with Nirma. Oh, I've forgotten it. Biru. And Nirma is a assistant psychologist. And as always, we're going to have a chat about, not as always, but we're going to have a chat about, I suppose, her career and her opinions on mental health and some questions that I've got. So, yeah, let's get into it. How are you doing, Nirma? How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Give everyone what is an assistant psychologist and what it is that you do. And I suppose on from that, what got you into it in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So as an assistant psychologist, within my service, at least, I work for the NHS. It's kind of like doing some assessments for the services to see whether the individuals, they meet the criteria and if the service would be able to support them with their mental health needs. I also deliver kind of like low intensity therapy to the clients while they are on the waiting list for therapy. And then, of course, the research bit where we do data collection, analysis, and really mentoring as well. Some aspiring psychologists, like honorary assistant psychologists. So I do mentor them as well.
Awesome. And what was it about psychology that sparked your interest, and why did you think, let's explore that avenue?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Mauritius, and Mauritius is quite like a diverse cultural country. And during my schooling there, I was doing some volunteering with some psychologists, and that really intrigued me as to how different cultures see psychology, see mental health in general. Coming back to the UK, I was deciding what to do, and psychology just attracted me. And I was like, okay, I'm just doing psychology. I just want to serve the population, really, in feeling better, in coping better.
Yeah, that's a good goal. That's why we're here today. So that's where that makes sense. Did you get a conclusion, or did you make any discoveries about the different ways that cultures treat mental health and psychology, or what did you discover?
It's still ongoing, let's say, but I have come to terms with how different communities see mental health. For me, it was at some point disturbing to see that certain communities, certain ethnicities see mental health differently than I would see it, or my friends would see it, or my family would see it. So it was a difficult path to come to terms with, but it's made me more resourceful and understanding. And I think that has made me a better professional, let's say. And obviously creating content on like Instagram, the main aim was to support everyone that I can, regardless of age, ethnicity, culture, religion, race, everything. So that's why the main thing for me is to support them there.
So what are some of the biggest, what cultures have you looked at or experienced, and what differences have you seen play out?
So one of the main differences of how we see mental health, I was obviously looking more into kind of like South Asian communities in comparison to the white British community. And it's just kind of like generation gaps as well, how they see it, how things are interpreted in terms of like tradition, culture, religion beliefs as well, the barriers that people actually come across to coming for therapy, for example, or accepting that they have a new diagnosis, or coming to terms that it's not only a bad day, it's actually you need actually more help sometimes. So yeah, that was quite interesting, and I'm still exploring, so hopefully I will get to know more about those barriers and those differences.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah. it is very, I suppose, part of growing up in one culture is you're restricted mm-hmm. in your way of understanding and you're sort of limited in the resources you have access to as a result of growing up. And sometimes that, in some ways that's beneficial, and in some ways that can be a hindrance. Quite often it's both, or a bit of both. So that's really good. So what does an assistant psychologist do? What do you do on a day-to-day basis? What does your sort of working day look like in terms of research and helping people and assisting whoever?
Yeah, well, it looks busy to start with. Within my service, I fortunately do have a lot of like clinical exposure. So I am assessing clients, as I said before, I'm assessing clients to see if this is, if the service can offer support for their mental health needs. I would also contact clients while they're in the waiting list and offer them low intensity skills coaching course, which is basically called where I'm offering basic coping skills, but at the same time it's their space to talk about anything that might have been a problem or has been difficult, any kind of like difficulty, or even sometimes something that went really well, better than expected. In terms of research, at the moment I'm working on a research paper that we're looking into assessing outcome measures. So on a day-to-day basis, this is a little bit like, in a nutshell, a little bit of what I do.
That's good. Yeah. Nice. Broad array of different things. Let's talk about your Instagram, because that was how we got in contact and what drew me towards you. When did you start treating your Instagram the way you've been treating it? And when did you start thinking, I'm going to start uploading content on Instagram, and why are you doing that?
So I started this Instagram during the pandemic. I am someone, I don't want to say I'm an extrovert or an introvert, I'm like the in-between kind of person. And during the pandemic, although I like staying at home, it was really affecting me mentally. I felt isolated, I felt bounded within my walls. I felt caged, really. And although I was working in psychology and like mental health, I was aware, okay, this is what I can do to make myself feel better. Although I was doing all that, I just couldn't cope. It was really difficult. So I said, okay, so if I'm having those difficulties, other people are as well. So I started this Instagram then. My first post was about myths of mental health. And obviously the following people started by my friends, my family, and then it grew from there. And hopefully will still continue growing. But the main aim is to build awareness, to reduce stigma, and really kind of like tell everyone that mental health actually matters. Like little triggers, little things, little motivation quotes, little things can actually make such a big difference in your life. So yes, I'm using my platform to reach out to as many people as I can to share that message with them.
That's good. Yeah, very well said. Quotes and videos and everyone uses Instagram and social media and their phones to such an incredible degree now that you might as well try and funnel something useful out of it. So it makes complete sense, and it's very beneficial to the people that engage in it. And there's definitely a market out there. So that's great. You said one of the first things you put up was mental health myths. What are some mental health myths that are in our society?
I think there are a couple, and obviously it will change with time, or it might, like, new myths can come up. But the main kind of myth that I can think of is there is a myth which says it's not normal to struggle. I think it's one of the most long-standing myth that I have known, even when I was back in uni doing my undergrad. It's just to say that although mental health struggles, it is a normal part of the human condition. We all have bad days. We all have a little bit of like low mood here and there. And it's not normal to struggle. That myth in itself, we're trying to kind of break part of that mental health stigma and openly kind of discussing that many people will need mental health support at some point in their life. So, even though that we don't have like a diagnosis or something, it's not normal to struggle is a myth. It's okay to struggle. It's what do we do about this struggle, which is important. So that's kind of one of them. The second one that I can think of, it's mental health struggles are inevitable. So there's nothing you can do about it. Although it's normal to struggle, you don't have to suffer. So for example, if you find your life, there are like keeping on fulfilling your goals and it's really coming into the normal life you have and like your function, your daily functioning. For some, professional mental health is part of that solution. For others, for example, self-care, coping skills, breathing techniques, YouTube videos, all of that can be useful. So what matters the most is what makes you feel empowered to do something to support your own mental health. So that's another one. What can I think of other?
Those two are pretty powerful. There's a great book. There's a great professor called Steve Peters who wrote a book called The Chimp Paradox.
Yeah.
Really good. I watched him on a podcast and I think if everyone could know this about mental health, it would be really, really powerful. He said, I think the host asked him, how can someone achieve consistent happiness or consistent well-being? Mm-hmm. And the guy said, it's probably not possible because the chimp in the brain is designed to not be incredibly emotionally stable and to react to its environment as a result of a survival mechanism, survival instinct. So he says is actually, I think he twisted it and said it's actually a sign of a healthy mind, someone who is reacting to obviously if we didn't react to certain stimuli we would be dead. So you can't, unfortunately, it may not be possible, but it's what you said, it's about that, it's the difference between suffering, it becoming suffering as opposed to it originating as a reaction and it growing into suffering. So I think that would be such a helpful piece of information if everyone knew, because it would basically say there's nothing wrong with your brain. It's just how the brain works. It's just how the monkey mind works. And you don't have to necessarily listen to it. I think that would be another helpful thing to know. You don't have to necessarily engage in it. So those are two good myths. Absolutely. I like that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. So you put something up on your Instagram about please stop saying this too. And then you were putting, I wanted to say it's a really, I like the idea. And
thank you.
Are these things that you heard, phrases that you heard being spoken to children and adults in the practice, or are they things that you've sort of collated together and gone, those need to be addressed?
I think I picked it up a little bit from here and there, like work, professionals, clients, family, friends, even. The thing is, the English language in itself, it has different slangs. For example, in London, we have different slangs. In Birmingham, Newcastle, we'll have different slangs. So we often hear something in movies, social media, TV, the news, and depending on the kind of like the slangs of the area, we change the words, we change the phrases, and we end up using some words and some phrases in the wrong way. there are definitely some people that uses the terms, the correct terms, to kind of like normalize their diagnosis and speak to others about it. But at the same time, we also have things that are said that invalidate people. Things like, I'm so OCD about cleaning, or you're a yeah. grown man, or what can I think of? How can you eat so much and not get fat? My ex is psychotic, or things like that. You actually hear that on a daily basis in like normal conversations between people. And you think they're actually just using those words and those phrases as adjectives, as expressions. But at the same time, they're invalidating people, because someone experiencing OCD, for example, it's much more than just wanting to clean. Someone who diagnosed with PTSD, for example, has experienced a really traumatic event. Someone who probably is being able to eat and not put on weight, there might be so much more going on behind the scenes. So it's just the way that we pick up things, that we say things sometimes. We just have to be mindful that we are, one, stigmatizing, and secondly, the negative impact it could have on someone. If I'm in a conversation with someone and talking that way and saying those things, it might impact the person, but if someone else overhears as well, it might have an impact on the person overhearing that as well. So it's just about using the right jargon, using the right words, using the right phrases when talking to people, and not invalidating, really. So this is how this idea came from. And I just wanted to kind of like put it out there to not use the words when you're not sure about it. Like, do some research, and then if you want to use it in like the correct way, then please do. It's actually better, because then you're normalizing something, a diagnosis or the emotions of someone or what they're experiencing. But do not use it when you're not sure. So that was kind of the main aim there.
That's very true. Learning or knowing what to say at the right time is such a difficult thing to do, especially for even for someone who's well trained. You're not going to hit you quite often not going to hit the mark straight away, because everyone's in an individual. So it's so hard. You can build like a rough sort of a grouping of answers in a certain situation, but the chances of you hitting the nail on the head with the perfect thing to say is really difficult. And it's obviously difficult for the person who you're saying it to, because they're like, I want you to tell me that I want you to make me feel better. I want the right answer. But it's also hard for the person who's saying it, because even if they're well-intentioned, they can get it wrong. And that can be disheartening for them and for the person. And it's not necessarily their fault. It's, we're not mind readers, when we don't have, no one has magic wand. So it's very interesting, very difficult. And going back to the, I think I did, it was either at college or maybe at uni, we all had to research the stigmatization of mental health through like media, and how films and movies and television programs have contributed to the stigmatization of mental health. And I think schizophrenia is the most commonly stigmatized condition. And it gets a really, really bad rap because it's often used as like a horror villain sort of origin story or character profile. Yeah. And it's very detrimental to, and schizophrenia is an awful condition to have. So that's not bad, but that's really bad. And going back, and also, as you pointed out, the OCD, that's one that bugs me all the time. They say, oh, I'm so OCD. I don't know why that's got into, I don't understand how that's, I kind of do, but what they really mean is I'm just orderly. I'm so orderly, but it's somehow they turn into, it's been twisted into OCD. So that's another interesting one. Yeah, I'm not sure how you tackle that.
I think the OCD one is one of the main ones said, actually. And it's actually sad because it's just not about cleaning.
No, exactly. Yeah. And also OCD is an incredibly, I was reading an article, I think it said OCD is the seventh most debilitating disease, not just mental health, just disease in general. So like it's an awful disease when someone really gets under the grip, when OCD gets under the grips of them, their life just closes in on them. And especially if it's like a contamination OCD, which obviously it's not always, but when it is, it just your life shrinks around you because you know the OCD monster, to use colloquial term, just gets to you. Yeah. What you put a thing up on your Instagram about sadness versus depression, and I think this you kind of touched on it anyway, and I think this is a really very 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 important topic in the modern world, and it's quite hard to differentiate between sadness and depression, I suppose, in some ways, at least from a sensational point of view. Maybe it's not, but going back to the thing we spoke about, the chimp paradox, it is basically that muddies the water as well. So how is sadness defined against depression?
Being sad it's a normal reaction to kind of like a difficult time in life. So being happy, being sad, being angry, they're very normal reactions. Usually kind of like when you're feeling sad, it will go after a little time. We all experience sadness. We all feel sad at some point of our life. But depression is different. It is a mood disorder in itself. And that can cause like severe symptoms, such as like having difficulties in handling your daily activities like sleeping, eating, or even functioning, working, things like that. So when a person kind of experiences sadness, you can have some relief from either venting, talking out frustration, or even crying. And usually sadness is kind of related to a specific trigger. Depression, it might just be different triggers. It might just be a set of triggers together. It might just be a series of things together that can cause depression. And if usually sadness in itself doesn't go after some time, this is when you should be concerned if that's affecting your normal functioning. This could be a sign of depression. But the clear cut difference between the two is sadness will actually go after some time, but depression, it affects how you feel on a longer period of time. So that was one of the kind of main things. I think going back to the previous question about how we see sadness and depression, some people would say, well, I feel really depressed nowadays. It's really about assessing whether you're experiencing low mood because a specific trigger, or is it you're actually having symptoms of depression once again. So that's the main difference, I think.
Yeah, it opens up a really complicated question, which, because I've worked in schools with a mainstream school and special needs school, and one of the things, and dealing with myself and friends, etc., one of the things that is quite difficult to sort of work out is how much, because a lot of the time they'll say suffering is suffering, doesn't matter what's going on. But I always query that, and I think, well, yes, you're right, suffering is suffering and everyone deserves to be listened to. But if someone has a broken leg and you've cut your finger, it actually isn't helpful for you for me to act as if you've broken your leg, because then you're going to react, then you're upping the ante, and that's something that it's a hard one to weigh up, and it's very often dependent upon the person who's interacting with them. Do you understand what I mean? You don't want to overinflate something, but you don't want to underinflate it either, because if you overinflate it, it actually A, undermines the people who have broken a leg to some degree, and B, it's not going to help the person who's cut their finger, because all it means is that they're just going to be more anxious, or, you know, anxious, whatever the pathology is, they're going to be more, suffer more because they think they've broken a leg, but they've actually cut their finger. But as you know, as I said, it's incredibly difficult to manage. What's your take on that? Or do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's talk. A really good point that you kind of like pointed out there. You wouldn't want to make someone feel like they have broken it if they have like a cut finger. And it's the same for mental health. If you are experiencing something, sometimes one of the things we want to experience, or rather someone experiencing mental health disease or like, let's say depression, they would want to be validated. They would want to be listened to. But if you just say, okay, it's just sadness, that's kind of invalidating. But at the same time, you don't know which one is which if you don't pay attention to it yourself. So if, for example, you're feeling sad over kind of like 2-3 weeks, then it might be a concern. But if you feel sad for a day or two, it is still valid for sure, but it might just be because of a specific trigger. And I think that's kind of like the main difference. And I think it's an ongoing debate because you could never kind of point out, is it actually sadness or is it actually depression? And if you try to have that conversation with someone who might be sad or in the moment that they are not feeling quite well, you will invalidate anyway. So it's a really difficult one actually, because you don't know how to address it really at some point.
And the brain and the psyche is unbelievably complicated, and it's absolutely, you know, it's got a limitless number of layers to it and an incredible number of confounding variables and all this mess going on. It's chaotic. Mm-hmm. So navigating that it's far more complicated than navigating a broken leg or appendix. It's you know, I did another podcast with a guy. He was talking about how he was talking to a senior when he was going through medical school. He said he asked what profession or what specialty should I go into, and he said it depends how invasive you want to be. And he said if you want to do something invasive, if you want to do the most invasive practice, go into mental health. And he was considering to become a surgeon. So this guy basically said that mental health practitioner is a more invasive profession than being a surgeon, which is quite something, isn't it, to think of.
I agree.
I think that makes sense, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
The mind is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You put something up, I think, on your Instagram about unconscious programming and how to become aware of it, and how can we maybe override is the correct word, but maybe it's the wrong word. How can we maybe sidestep it or become aware of it is the best term, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh God. The unconscious mind in itself.
I know. Yeah.
The most complicated part of everything. Most of the content that the unconscious mind holds, it's considered to be kind of like the most unpleasant one, such as like the feeling of pain, guilt, anxiety, things like that. But the unconscious mind plays such a crucial role in like shaping our self-image. It influences our habits or even guides us to like decision-making processes. If you think of the iceberg, for example, the imagery of the iceberg in itself, we always see the top the tip of the iceberg. Whatever's underneath, it's what the unconscious mind holds, basically. So it kind of really has like most of like the deepest desires, fears, aspiration. And I think sometimes this is why we often kind of like operate on an autopilot to protect us and help us navigate. And that's, according to like my understanding, this is what the unconscious mind does. So kind of my understanding of that whole unconscious mind and why I shared it was during childhood, our mind is like programmed. The unconscious mind is programmed. So we're like on download mode,
like,
for example,
sponge.
If you want. Yeah. So we're learning about the world. We're learning how to exist in the world. We're learning about everything. So we're very receptive to the things that we're told, the things that we see. So past, like the past events program, our mind and then conscious memories can run the show, basically. So for example, if the coping strategy of a six-year-old was you feel quite clingy because you don't get enough love, that same pattern can continue in adulthood. And or if you've learned to kind of like stay busy and constantly productive, this might be a way to numb your feelings, and you've never learned to kind of feel and process those feelings, this could continuously be a pattern. So the aim was really to kind of like step aside, as you said, to kind of like create time, the coping strategies that we create at the time, to kind of look into that, because those days are with us our whole life, really. So by working with that unconscious mind through like practices like positive affirmations, visualizations, things like that, we can actually reprogram our unconscious mind at some point and unlock our true potential and overcome self-sabotage. Self-sabotage is one of the main things that the unconscious mind can push us to do, basically. So kind of understanding that power of the unconscious mind, it allows us to really unleash that true potential and make positive changes in our lives. So I always kind of say that to my friends, my families, and even my clients, embracing the beauty of uncertainty is okay. By doing that, it helps you to like focus on gratitude, like things you could be grateful for. And it really helps you to be kind of mindful and reflective of the environment, because the environment we live in, the surroundings, this is where we often absorb all the information and all our beliefs come from. And in turn, this is the main thing that shapes our personality, that shapes how we think, how we behave. So really it was to kind of like push people to think a little bit out of the box. I think there was one of the posts that I did put on my Instagram was like the half full or the half empty cup pose. It's the perspective that you see it, and one of them is the correct way for you, for example. The other way is correct for me. So it's really how to reprogram and really it's really understanding that it's okay, that the unconscious mind is not the bad mind, for example. We just have to know how to work with
it. How do you find the right therapist? I wanted to ask you that because I thought that was a really interesting post to put up.
Yeah, so choosing the right therapist, I think, was the kind of title. So I think therapy in itself is for everyone who wants to do the work that it takes to get through a tough situation. I think then in my post, I did say choosing the right therapist, but when I was reflecting about it afterwards, I did feel probably choosing wasn't the right word, because usually you do get to choose. You have that flexibility. If in the UK, for example, if you're going with the NHS, you don't have that. You can't choose your therapist. If you're going private, obviously you can. But then the NHS, you would most of the time be allocated to someone. You could have like specific requests like gender, ethnicity, things like that. But you can't always get what you would like. So if I could go back and probably change that, it would be how to work through the right, like making sure the right therapist is helping me. So I think in my post I did kind of point out specific kind of criteria. So the ones that I can think of like on top of my head is one, confidentiality. So I know it is really important for the therapist and the patient to maintain confidentiality. The patient is coming, putting their trust in someone. And that's, I think, the whole point of building the therapeutic relationship as well. So if the therapist is breaching confidentiality, then clearly that's not the right person anyone would want to work with. However, all therapists has an ethical duty to do so. And in all sessions, we reiterate confidentiality. We reiterate that it's really important. So that's one of them. Secondly, I can think of empathy. So whether the therapist understands your struggle is really important. Like, are they able to connect with you on like an emotional level? When I say connect, it's not like relating to their experiences or to other people's experiences. It's rather than empathy and compassion towards what you're sharing. Actually, if they do relate to someone else or to their experiences, this is kind of a red flag already. Another one that I can think of is active listening. You want to be heard. You want to be seen. You want to be made like, okay, this is my space. This is my time. So it is really important for the therapist to kind of give you the full attention. And if you had, if anyone has any kind of doubts, questions, it is okay to clarify that. And the therapist should always be there to assist you with any questions. So that is another kind of, let's say, green flag. And obviously, flexibility and adaptability, because every individual is different for sure. And we all have our goals. It might be similar goals, but the way we set it, the way we're working towards it, it's different. So a therapist should have that flexibility to adapt according to the individual's need and help them and encourage them to kind of set more realistic goals based on their needs. And I think one last thing that I can think of, but I think which is really important, it's expertise. So as you might know, there are like many different types of therapies out there. And it is really important that you or anyone who's going for therapy always check that they know what they're getting. If they are expecting, for example, CBT and going into like a psychotherapy service, you have to understand that not all therapists are trained in all the different types of therapies. So it is okay for a patient to ask, is that what you offer? Are you is that your expertise? It's okay. And if a therapist says, that's not my expert area, but I can do some work, that's not correct. That shouldn't be done. So I think taking all of those criteria, it is important to see if therapy is working for you. And I think this is also a way to assess whether you're getting the best out of therapy.
Yeah, you raise a good point about going to, I suppose maybe it depends, because maybe it would be beneficial to see a therapist who's trained and well-versed in an array of different therapeutic practices, but it could also be better to find someone who's incredibly, their expertise lies in one specific one, especially if that one specific practice is very relevant to what it is that you're coming to them for. Like if you have some logistical difficulties and you're quite a type A sort of go-getter person, then maybe CBT could be very helpful, because it would be able to lay out the cognitive and the behavioral correlation between your actions and how you're feeling. But then if you're someone who is suffering, you're slightly oblivious to what it is that is impeding you, and you're not as aware on what it is you need to work on, maybe CBT isn't necessarily the best option, because there could be more, you know, subconscious or unconscious things at play. And as much as I agree, practicality is an important aspect, because obviously we're practical beings, but maybe it's not, there shouldn't be the first port of call for someone who's suffering from a chronic condition as opposed to a pinpointable condition. But yeah, you lay out a lot of good information there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right. I've got a couple more questions, but I don't want to keep you too long because it is your evening. But I wanted to ask you about personality and your opinion. I think you put a post about personality recently, and I'm incredibly interested with personality. I think it's very underused and maybe researched, but it's not as well known as it should be. How personality can impact us. So, how have you found personality impacted the people that you've treated or that you've researched, or even in your own personal life?
I think the post was how to define personality, something like that.
Okay, possibly, yeah. I just saw personality and thought, oh, perfect. I'll ask her about that.
Yeah, so in my professional and personal life, I've always come across people talking about how other people make them feel. And this is based on their way they behave, the way their achievements, how they are in life, their age. Their achievement according to age was a really big one for me. So it's really like how social factors define personality for them and how it has impacted them. So for me, although there is kind of like the more theoretical part to personality, for me it was more to highlight that this does not define your personality. Age, your achievements, your ethnicity, your race, your religion, your backgrounds, your cultural backgrounds, all of those does not define your personality. We are all individuals. I might have a similar personality to someone who is completely in a different ethnic group than I am, or vice versa. So the main aim was to make people understand that we have specific things that define personality, and it is for sure not the ones that could make us feel judged. And one of the things that really spot on for me, like it actually annoys me, is we often judge people on the things that we feel we want as well, or we could envy. So this is something I read in one of a paper, which said we have self-judgments, but the judgments of others are more detrimental because we take those judgments, we sit with them, and we think, okay, this is me, or this is what defines me. So it was just basically stepping out of that picture and saying, no, that does not define you. What defines you is the person you are, the things you do, the opinions you have, your actions towards a situation. That's what defines you, and not the basic demographics or the basic social ladder things, rather.
That's really
answer the question. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that I've just as we've been talking, you often refer to sort of like socialization and things. How much do you think people are impacted by their socialization, and how much do you think is innate, we're born with? Because it's another topic of, you know, nature versus nurture, which one is more powerful? And yeah, in your experience, which one do you, it's, I suppose it's so impossible because they're intrinsically linked, aren't they? But
yeah,
what's your opinion on that debate?
Oh God, that's like the most known ongoing debate in psychology. I still stick to my first opinion before I started psychology, is they're both equally important. They both equally have an impact. The nature, like our genetics, our upbringings, our opinions, the social gatherings we go to, the socialization, as you say, that we have around us, they all equally play a role in our life, in the way we behave, in the way we do things, in the way we respond to things. So I just still think that they are both equally as important, and I don't personally think that one has a heavier importance than the other. You need both. You basically need both. And a balance of both can also give you a stable mental health, a stable mental well-being as well.
Yeah, balance. Yeah. What do you mean it can give you a mental, what do you mean a stable well-being?
So what I mean by that is, for example, if you are definitely kind of looking into, let's say, self-care, for example, but that self-care could mean different things for different people. So it could be self-care could be socializing with friends, but when you're socializing with friends, that could have an impact on you as well. Then you might pick up something. So it's really finding that balance, that individual balance. Everyone would find their own balances. And I think this, the word stable in itself, stable mental health in itself, differs for everyone. What I could feel is stable for my personal well-being, mental well-being, would be different for you, for example. So it really is a one-to-one thing. It really is how everyone perceives it, how everyone practices it as well.
That makes sense. Yeah, as always, it comes down to the individual, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's talk about your mental health. We'll make this the last topic. How do you regulate your own mental health in your profession, and how do you manage everything?
Well, I try to practice what I preach, really, before.
Very, anything. Very good.
Yeah, I'm only human, and sometimes it is so impossible to actually apply the things that I share, especially when I'm having a bad day. But I really try to self-care and have like that me time. And that me time could be like simple things like doing my nails or eating chocolates or just staying away from my phone, things like that, little things like that. And I think on like a professional level as well, I do have clinical supervision, which is so helpful. Yes. And lately I have been trying to go back to the gym because it kind of really releases like all my stress hormones, my cortisol, my everything. And I feel so refreshed afterwards. So yeah. I'm on that. And, really, content creation is really a big thing for me, because whenever I'm writing about like a topic or something, I'm actually reading through papers, I'm listening to podcasts, I'm going into blogs. So sometimes there is so much work, it takes probably 2-3 days of work behind putting one post. But that gives me the spam to be reflective, to think about, okay, how can I apply that in my life, or how can I probably apply that to it in my work, or how can I suggest that to someone? So yeah, so I just try to really put everything out there and try and regulate my own mental health with that. But as I said, I'm only human, and there are so many times that I can't apply the things that I share myself. And that's not because I don't want to, it's because I'm really struggling. But then I do different things like mindfulness activities. I'll just sit with those uncomfortable feelings as well sometimes, and then just work on it the next day. And yeah, this is how I try to regulate it.
Yeah. I always feel like the psyche is looking for balance wherever it goes, whatever you do. So
yeah.
I get this weird phenomena sometimes where I'll write a post about something, or I'll discover something, and I'll find myself doing the opposite of what I should be doing straight afterwards after the next few days. And it's kind of like, I can't work out what it is. It's maybe it's some sort of balancing act that the psyche is trying to sort of, if you, because as I said, I think that I really do believe the psyche is always looking for balance. And if you kick something out one way, it will always kick back the other way. That can be quite complicated. I haven't quite thought about it enough, or probably experienced it enough yet, but I feel there's something to that. But that is good. And as you said, we're only human. And another thing is, you are right. I imagine you get a lot of regulation from your job. If you're inclined that way, then, you've got to find what it is that is sustainably regulates you, not short term, but long term. And if you have that sort of temperament, then helping people is something that will sustainably regulate you. Doesn't necessarily mean it will be a panacea and get rid of all your problems, but it will, over sort of, in the final analysis, it's beneficial for you, and that's the main thing. Awesome.